Twofootedtackle.com.
Yes, we've finally reached the end of the season, and to celebrate it, a bumper 51st edition of the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Although after a bumper haul of pods, we're not going to do a Mourinho and leave for Spain. So yes, it's Yesway Jose, a warm welcome to Ollie's Barmy Army as interim Blackpool both triumph, while there's despair in DC as United crash to yet another defeat, plus our roundups of Ligue 1 and the Bundesliga, the World Cup, and much more. Well, Adam Moore on the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Yes, hello. Welcome. Final pod of the season. Just as we went huge for last week's 50th birthday pod, we're going to go even bigger for the final pod of the season. It's another very packed studio. So joining us this week, in no particular order, Chris Nee. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Hi. The Sound of Football, some people on the pitch, and the Onionbergs, Terry Devlin. Terry, hello.
Hi.
Hi. A man who also writes for the same place as what Terry does, Graham Sibley. Graham, hello. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. And finally, another man from the same blogs, completing the set, if you will, Chris Oakley. Great to have you here, Chris.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Fantastic. Okay, right.
He's such a pro, isn't he? It's great to be here.
He's always on. Always on.
There's no opposition on the genius switch, let me tell you.
I'd like to apologise in advance, just in case you think sort of we sound like we're chewing at all, because we've got Haribo in the studio at the moment that we've been all chewing through beforehand. Football.
Other low-quality sweets are available.
Indeed they are. They were just trying to...
Rotten World Cup 2010.
They were just kind of bought because I was in Tesco's before, and then it's like, oh, football mix, okay.
Other right, low-quality supermarkets are available.
I think Tesco's is excellent. I heartily endorse it.
We're not endorsed by any of them at all, obviously. Anyway, let's fly straight into the Champions League, which some of us endorse, some of us have our other opinions on. Graham, Inter were very much the favourites going into that game, so it's no surprise they're not only champions of Europe, but they've also completed a very historic treble.
Yeah, only the sixth team to do it, but second team in a row to win the League and Cup double and then the Champions League as well. So, yeah, a great achievement, really, considering that, you know, for the large parts of the end of the Serie A season, they didn't look like they were going to canter over the line as everyone thought they did earlier on.
And Jose, I mean, we all talk about the fact that perhaps Inter, they're not Barcelona, essentially.
No.
But you've got to give them credit. They are a fantastically organised team, aren't they? And the two, Milito's second goal was a thing of beauty.
Oh, beautiful. It was really beautiful. I mean, it was a such a solid performance, really. I mean, if Jose had set down a script to say what's going to happen, right, Milito's going to score in the 35th and 70th minute, I wouldn't have been that surprised if it was like all there in his notes beforehand, because it just looked exactly like that. Bayern didn't really have a clue, did they, really? I mean, it was... They were, I mean, like, if 2-0 can be a thumping, it was, really, because although they saw a lot of the ball, they couldn't do anything with it. It reminded me a lot, actually, of the last time when Liverpool played Milan, when Ancelotti basically gave Gerrard loads of space and loads of the ball, but he couldn't end up doing anything with it. And it was the same with Robin, I thought. Robin was given a lot of possession, but, you know, just couldn't seem to get anything out of the Inter defence, and in the end, I mean, you just looked utterly clueless, really.
Terry, as our resident German expert on here, do you think Bayern were Graham's being a bit disingenuous to Bayern, or do you think that they generally were definitely the losing team on there without a shadow of a doubt?
Most definitely, I think that Bayern were like a bird in a cage. They were given plenty of room to fly around, but they couldn't get out of the cage. Inter were superb. To use another metaphor, they picked up Bayern by the ankles and shook all the chains out of them. Extremely, I mean, 39% possession from Inter on that night. Mm-hmm. I did a bit of going back. We had to go. I don't know whether you can go back that far at all to the last time that somebody won a Champions League final or with that kind of possession. The nearest was Porto. Under Jose Mourinho, and the time before that was Real Madrid against Bayern Leverkusen, but only slightly less than 50%. But to control the game in a classic, beautiful, sort of virtuous Italian style, had echoes of the old Catenaccio. in fact, had echoes, to borrow, I'm borrowing my opinion from Jonathan Wilson here, but they had echoes of Herrero's Inter from the 60s, the last time they won the European Cup. So I thought that they were absolutely awesome, and I think in a way it'll be bad for football, because I think it'll be, a lot of people will look at that and go, right, that's how we're going to win, they're going to play, and they'll do it really badly. But I think when it's done like that, they were just epic, really, really epic. Well, Lito and Pandev and Eto, for me, key players for because of their willingness to play like fullbacks 1 minute and then forwards next. It's sensational performance by Inter.
Do you think... Oh, sorry.
It's interesting, actually, when you consider how Inter started this Champions League campaign, because especially in the Italian press, they can't wait to get on the back of Mourinho, especially not at the beginning of the season. But they were... Before they got their first win, they'd gone 8 games in the Champions League without a win, and it was basically seemed like you know Italian football was, you know, in danger of losing its fourth spot to Germany, and it still could have happened even up to this game.
Indeed.
And really for them to, it's been quite a turnaround. I think it's a fabulous achievement, considering as well that this was the season that Real and Barcelona had spent huge, and I think everyone was really anticipating Barcelona really to just
definitely, yes,
hold on to it with an iron grip.
Chris Oakley, do you think that Inter are kind of worthy conquerors of Europe at all, or would you have liked to have, are you one of those people who much prefers a more beautiful type of football like Bayern, not Bayern, sorry, Barcelona do?
I'm quite a fan of the way Inter play, to be honest. There's a sort of a beauty that's inherent in it that you perhaps have to look for a bit harder. But I think fundamentally, the way they set up to play and out-tactic the opposition, as they've done on a few occasions, I think it's absolutely fine. I'm quite happy to watch Inter in preference, say, to Barcelona if necessary. What I was going to add to that, in fact, in the final was... with regards to the final, was that they didn't sort of score one and then park the bus. They didn't park the bus until like 5 minutes from the end. So that goes to prove that they didn't just play boring, ultra defensive football. They just did whatever they had to do. And if it means kind of giving Bayern plenty of possession and letting them get themselves knackered and basically sort of devoid of any ideas on how to win the game, fine. I think it's a very admirable way to get your team playing, personally.
They weren't like Greece in 2004, where they did park the bus for the entire tournament. They controlled the game without having the ball.
Yeah.
They just allowed Bayern only into areas that they were happy for them to go. It's extraordinary. It's nothing like boring, ultra-dull defensive football. Mm. It's a completely different way of... It's total control football.
Mm. It's kind of like a taxi driver on a go slow, as opposed to a bus driver who's broken down.
Exactly. I was just about to say that. Now, you obviously got that from Jonathan Wilson as well. I can tell.
Chris, what do you make though? Now, it's kind of almost been overshadowed by Mourinho going. You know, well, looks like he's off to Real Madrid. Yes. Of course, Inter don't want him to go. It's not been anything official there, but Pellegrini's now gone from Real Madrid. What do you make of that all?
Well, of course, when you become as sort of successful as Mourinho is, then obviously you're going to have lots of suitors queuing up around the block to take him on. And, you know, unfortunately, we don't live in a world where, you sort of claim your loyalty to a team any longer than you have to. If somebody waves a big fat cheque in front of you, then unfortunately, the days of sticking with your club through thick and thin are gone. And as it is, it's unsurprising that someone like Real Madrid sort of say, well, okay, we're a bit sort of starved of glory at the moment, so we've got the money, come and work for us. I don't think it's any detriment to Jose Mourinho when you're as successful as he's been. You just say fair play to him, and let's see if he can replicate this sort of success at another club, another country, indeed. So I just think it's great for Jose Mourinho, and next season we're probably going to have a new challenge. We're going to see if he can crack it in Spain.
And Chris, do you think he can crack it in Spain?
Well, I don't see why not. He's got the resources, but we all know his dream would have been to manage Barcelona, and he just happens to have hit a point in his career where actually they've got their own manager who's in there trying to change football paradigms as well, and he's never going to get that job. And now he will make it his mission to topple Barcelona. It
makes for a fascinating La Liga next season.
It does, and he'll have the resources to do it. But it looks very much like Barcelona are going to spend ridiculous money as well.
Villa and possibly Fabregas. That's just a scary team. in terms of what they've amounted. Of course, there was another game, perhaps with even more at stake, being played on Saturday. As it's become commonly known, the £90 million match. Its real name is the Championship Player Final. See who gets that final Premier League spot. Chris Nee, the Romantics' favourite was Ian Holloway's Blackpool, and they are now incredibly in the Premier League after an incredible 45 minutes, really, of football where all the action happened.
Yeah, well, the second 45 minutes was intriguing as well, but the first half was just absolutely thunderous. Fantastic game. The third goal was the first time that Blackpool had been in the lead, but they always looked in control. I mean, as soon as Cardiff scored their first goal, Blackpool always just looked like they had the edge. They never looked like they weren't going to get back into it, and it was a superb performance, as it was in the two semi-final games. And Holloway, in those few games, plus getting in there in the first place, has proven actually he's got quite a lot to him as a manager.
I mean, a lot of people think of Holloway, or Ollie as he's called, as a bit of a joker, and indeed he had that year out after being sacked from Leicester, which was a kind of slightly curious job to take at the time. But how do you think he will fare as a Premier League manager? Will he just be there as light entertainment at the end of match of the day, or do you think he'll actually cause a few upsets?
I think he will probably cause a few upsets, but I don't think it will be enough to give him more than a season. I think that they're not particularly well set up to survive, I don't think. Footballing teams generally struggle a little bit, and I think he knows that, and I think he'll probably do something to maybe compromise his style of play a little bit, but just shore up things a little bit more. But I don't think they have the resources to survive, I'm afraid.
Great for nostalgists, though, Terry. People who not even
you're old. Not,
that wasn't directly pointed at you, but you know, some people will remember Blackpool. I think Terry looks has a very youthful flash about him.
Thank you very much. I am old, though.
Some people will have long enough memories to remember Blackpool. I don't think too many of us will remember them in the top flight. But I mean, it's a big, famous old name there. Do you think that they've got any chance of competing in there? Or do you think it's just kind of one of those ones where they're going to get an awful lot of money, they're going to be able to redevelop the ground, and they'll be happy with that?
I don't think they've got a single chance of staying in the Premier League. I think it's fantastic that they're there. But they were, by rights, they would have been happy with mid-table championship. In fact, sixth really is kind of mid-table championship, given how fluid the championship table is. Their wage bill is tiny, their attendance is very, very low, their capacity is very low. I don't think they've got the ability to be able to generate any kind of income in any kind of space, shape of time to be able to bring in the kind of players that they need to stay up. I think if they go for those players, I would worry about their longer-term future, because they're going to cost an awful lot of money. I mean, you're not going to get a Premier League player, proper one, to come to Blackpool, not an experienced one, because, well, the money won't be good enough. The facilities aren't good enough. Their training facilities aren't good enough. They are a League One lower championship club that have suddenly found themselves in there. They don't have the facilities to accommodate proper Premier League players. If they go out and try and sign them, they'll be spending other people's money, and we all know what happens to clubs that do that these days. I think that Blackpool should go for it, have a wonderful time as much as possible, and who knows? Maybe they'll do something, but over a season, no chance. If Burnley can't do it, then I don't see how.
Well, Chris, Holloway has said that he's probably not going to compromise on his principles, which is a very attacking 4-3-3 formation that he's deployed throughout the season. He says he's not going to compromise on that. Could mean that we could have some very entertaining games involving the Tangerines.
Yeah, I think if given the fact that Burnley managed to cause a few upsets this season when they were in the Premier League, I don't see why, excuse me, that Blackpool can't. I'm not sure that it will last very long. It will probably burn out very quickly. But you know, there is this sort of story that he said when he had a year out from football that he was doing a bit of sort of punditry on BBC Radio, and he frankly was surprised at how defensive a lot of other teams were set up, and it was only sort of seeing it from this kind of extracted position that he finally vowed that if he got back into football, he was going to sort of go out and play attacking football, which is very admirable. But I think in practicality, it's not going to get him very far. But I look forward to seeing the end result of this, because as you say, there should be plenty of goals in the games they'll be playing, and might even get a few token big shock wins out of it as well.
Absolutely. Spare a thought, though, Graham, for the defeated team, Cardiff City. What now for them? Because they really needed that promotion. They're so far in debt, and they obviously they've got new people coming in the boardroom. Malaysians, Peter Risdale gone. Where do they go from here? Because, you know, administration, is that where it is?
Probably, yeah. And you've got to think, well, if a team that is massively in debt has got to the playoff final, then you think, well, you know, you've got there with all this debt, so, you know, maybe if you were a bit more financially prudent, then you wouldn't be up where you are, but then again, you wouldn't be about to go out of business. Yeah, it's a whole argument of you know, whether or not clubs should try and, you know, shoot for the moon and like spend beyond their means, and you know, the clear answer is no, don't do it. The prize isn't worth it, because
just say no.
Yeah. Just say no. Just say no to debt, man.
Financial doping.
Just say no to Peter Risdale as well.
Cardiff, you know, they'll have another season. I mean, like, yeah, they will survive, you know, as long as they've got love, you know, I'm sure. But no, I mean, like, I just want to, you know, Blackpool is going to be great. I mean, it's going to be great for away days, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, you think they'll probably open up as much as possible to get people. Yeah, exactly. Look at that face. I've been to Blackpool too. Come on. Oh.
Yeah, mind you, actually.
You went to see darts, though. Come on.
Yeah, no, nothing more refined than watching darts at the Winter Gardens in Blackpool, I can
tell
you.
Well, I'm thinking that probably is quite a lot more refined than seeing darts at the Winter Gardens in Blackpool. But
I think you might be right.
Can I just say, very quickly, although I'm not old enough to have seen Blackpool actually in the top flight last time they were in the top flight, as a West Ham fan, I've grown up having to see constant reruns of Match of the Day's biggest FA Cup shocks, of which West Ham in 1971, third round of the FA Cup, beaten 4-0 by Blackpool, Bobby Moore in the side and countless other stars. I've had to watch that for the last nigh on 40 years, and it's now time for revenge. I want West Ham to beat Blackpool.
You'll never get that revenge. Oh. That'll never happen.
It probably won't happen now, not the state West Ham's in. But anyway.
It is worth just also noting for historians, perhaps, who aren't that fully aware that Blackpool are a very historic club, and they are. I mean, theirs is the Matthews final, isn't it? It's Blackpool versus Bolton. It's that game. It's a huge game in English club footballing history. They're a very significant team, Blackpool. There is an element to that, and I think they will add that sort of timbre to the Premier League, what is a very, very brash and crass Premier League, by having Blackpool in it, which isn't remotely brash. Or
isn't that what Burnley were meant to do as well, weren't they?
It is true.
Blackpool's got a tower, though.
Yeah, and he's got a big dipper and all.
Twofootedtackle.com.
Well, all that talk of Cardiff City's financial difficulties brings us nicely to the issue of football finances. When we're talking finances, it's inevitable that we're also going to be talking supporters' trusts here on the pod. Supporters' Direct Conference starts on the 12th of June. Clubs in financial crisis will be just one of the topics that's being discussed there. Well, joining us on the line now is their chief executive, Dave Boyle. Dave, thanks for speaking to us again and coming on the pod. What's the aim of this conference?
We have a conference every year, Gary, where we bring together the supporters' trusts at the 150-odd clubs across the UK. But this year there's a special focus, really, which is following on from the agreement by the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives. They've made a commitment in that document to say that they're going to enable fans to run their clubs as supporter cooperatives. Now, that's pretty unprecedented for Supporters Direct and for football fans. So what we're now going to be starting to do is put some pressure on the new government to say we like very much the commitments you've made, now we want to actually help you take some action. So it's the start of a campaign, really, to actually get the government to take some action, which is going to give fans some real influence and involvement in the club's decision making.
How optimistic are you of getting anything on there? Because you say this is a fairly unprecedented situation. Are you optimistic it's going to be more than just talk from the politicians' end?
Well, at the very least, I would be looking for the new government to do whatever they could to support what we do at Supporters Direct. I mean, you know, there's 150-odd trusts now, and they didn't start for nothing. They didn't start out of nothing. One of the reasons they're there is because you've had an organisation like Supporters Direct, which has been promoting them and enabling them. But in terms of actually moving things on, I mean, it just seems to me, you know, you mentioned Cardiff. every day has some piece of news which basically says something's got to change in football. You know, for the last 5 years, we've been, it's felt at times like you're swimming against the tide, because the argument's always been, you know, what's the real problem with the game? What are the problems you people in the Supporters Trust movement are always sort of drawing our attention to? And it just seems to me that, that there's something which basically says, you know what, this isn't going to change unless somebody comes in from outside and really changes it. And the stuff which has been happening at the FA is just, you know, is just probably the most public and emblematic of that. But you can add to that, you can add Portsmouth, you can add the way in which the parachute payments deal has just been agreed. You can add in Cardiff City, you can look at Hull City, Liverpool, the mea culpa from David Moores yesterday, basically saying, I was completely stupid, and really people like me shouldn't be allowed to sell clubs to Americans bearing gifts. I mean, you know, these are all, these are sacred arguments which people have been making, saying you don't need regulation, you don't need oversight, you just need to trust the existing owners. And as I say, you know, more and more evidence comes to light which just says, you know, you people who think nothing should change, it's really becoming untenable.
Chris, how well do you think it's anything can be achieved at the moment? How optimistic are you that politicians will actually listen to to the likes of Supporters Direct?
I think I'm more optimistic than I would have been if you'd asked me a year or 2 years ago, simply because of the fact that there seems to be a feeling now that something has to be done, and more clubs seem to be getting themselves into trouble. And increasingly those clubs are being reborn as supporter movements. And I think that's created a public opinion that actually football isn't perfect and things do need to be fixed, and I think government has to respond to that.
Dave, do you think it's going to actually take perhaps a very big club? Perhaps you might have a complete and utter destruction worse than Portsmouth before we actually do get action, or do you think we can get to a stage where actually there can be changes and we might avoid something like that?
Well, certainly one of the arguments we'll be making is that, do you really want to leave it until one of our greatest clubs is actually on its knees? I mean, it's arguably Liverpool are not far off their knees at the moment, but my hope is that people will look at Portsmouth and say the reasons why Portsmouth ended up like they did are exactly the same reasons why any other club bigger than Portsmouth could end up there. My fear is that football has shown itself to be an incredibly conservative and change-averse sector, and I think it might unfortunately take one of the big clubs doing a Portsmouth. And, you know, it's funny how you say doing a Portsmouth. 10 years ago, it was doing a Chesterfield, and then it started to be doing a Leeds. And eventually, you know, I don't want to be in a position where we say someone's done a Liverpool, but I fear that's what it might take.
Do you think this is a good time to be talking about it, given what's come out of UEFA and Platini's proposals for European competition and to limit spending around that?
It's a fantastic time. I mean, you know, UEFA deserve a lot of credit. I keep trying to tune my ears to hear the walls of Jericho crumbling, which was apparently, if you listen to some of the British press, what would result if UEFA's proposals were successful. But UEFA, again, you know, there's an example there of three, four years ago when this first started to be mentioned, people said it couldn't happen, it was impossible, and then they said, well, even if it were possible, it would be so ill-advised. And yesterday it happened, and I think it's a useful reminder that actually things can change, that the people who've been making the kind of arguments we'll be making at our conference, that actually change is possible, that as much as sometimes it can be a bit depressing and pessimistic, that there are people out there who share the same vision and the same values, and some of them are very important people like Michel Platini, and there are supporters of that agenda in the UK too.
Just finally, coming out of the conference, what kind of solutions are you hoping to get that you can actually present to the powers that be and go, look, this is what we think as an organisation should happen. We've decided this at conference. This is what we think you should be doing.
Well, the two big ones we'll be pushing on is you've got a licensing scheme now which UEFA have brought in, which essentially means the Premier League now have a licensing scheme which regulates the spending they can make. What I think we need to see now is that brought in across the rest of English football. The conference are inching their way there. The Football League need to make the final step, and we need to get to the stage where every year, every club, not just those going to be in the Champions League, are made aware that they have to account for how they're going to spend their money. And the other thing we'd like to see is a real recognition by the powers that be who run the game that clubs are essentially only constituted as private companies by historical accident. What sustains them and what they truly are there because of their supporters. And and a good regulator and a good sport would do something more concrete to honour that and to recognise it. So we'll be asking the FA to be looking at making it part of the licensing system, that you have to have supporter involvement in running the club. You have to have a voice in there from somebody whose main interest is that the club is in a healthy state in 5, 10, 15 years' time, not just people around the table who are hoping that you might win something in the next 15 matches.
Okay, Dave, thank you very much. Have a great conference. That's just about it for part one. Stay tuned for part two. We'll be rounding up a league that knows all about supporter ownership, the Bundesliga. We'll also be taking a look at the shocks in Ligue 1, and that's coming up after this. Welcome back to part two of the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. Welcome back to the Bundesliga. The season in Germany is over, but there's been plenty of talking points, not least through the arrival of Steve McLaren at Wolfsburg. First of all, though, Terry, the title race, and despite losing the Champions League final, as we mentioned in the first half, Bayern still had a pretty successful season, didn't they?
A League and Cup double, yes, I believe so. Even in even modern parlance, a League and Cup double is still worth something. And impressive for a Cup final win over Werder Bremen 4-0. Werder Bremen, who were finishing the season extremely strongly, as they often do, in fact. So they would have fancied beating Bayern, I'm sure. And to lose 4-0 is a convincing result, especially ahead of the Champions League final. A real great morale booster ahead of the Champions League final, which, of course, we know they lost. But they were very good this season. They started off dreadfully, and I pronounced quite boldly on another podcast that Bayern Munich were rubbish. And I'm feeling a little bit foolish that they've ended up winning the season and the cup and getting to the Champions League final. But I still stick to it.
Apart from that.
Yeah. I've been extremely critical of Bayern Munich's back four. But I have to admit that when I was making those comments, I didn't realise Robin was coming to the club, and he's really transformed them. He's really made the difference. It's not all been great. Mario Gomez came in. He's not very good at all for them. He's much better for Stuttgart than he was at Bayern. Olic was a star player for them. Perhaps didn't have the invention at the very, very highest level, as was demonstrated in the Champions League final, but a fantastic player over the course of the season for them. And Ribéry was a bit of a disappointment, but turned out to be quite a good foil for Robin over the piece. But the most encouraging thing for Bayern is their youngsters. Tommy Müller, I think, will be a very good player. He's a bit lightweight at the moment, but I think will be a very good player. And Holger Badstuber in the defence, the right back, I think, left back, who will play in centre-half probably next season. And when you consider that they let Lucho go at the beginning of the season and didn't replace him, you have to say that Bayern have played extremely well. Or you could say that maybe the rest of the Bundesliga need to buck their eyes ears up a little bit in attack.
And incredibly, they were, Louis van Gaal, we all assumed, was going to go for the chop. Yet there he goes. Takes them to within an inch of a treble.
Well, he was probably hours away from the chop. It was the Juve game, final game. Yeah. that they incredibly won, which in a stroke saved Van Gaal's time at Bayern Munich and pretty much ruined Juventus' season. And in fact, probably reinforced all the things that were wrong with Juventus in one 90-minute swoop. It all looked terribly, terribly bleak for them. And back then they were awful. So they've done very well to turn it around in that kind of time. Although I would argue that they've been helped quite a lot by the opposition, by the other teams in the league who fell away, unfortunately.
Such as Leverkusen.
I know. Well, saying that Leverkusen broke the unbeaten league record. No team has lost, has gone on a longer unbeaten team in the league than Bayer Leverkusen than in this season. And yet they still managed to contrive to lose the championship. Quite spectacularly, they folded massively.
All the wheels fell off.
All the wheels fell off, not just one. And it's a shame, because in a way, because they do keep trying.
In fact, it was more like a circus car, wasn't it, really? It was like a clown car, everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honking horn.
That's what we was left with.
last year, you could point to Patrick Helmer's injury, and you could point to the fact that they had to spend half a season playing in Dusseldorf, because... I just find something inherently funny about the name Dusseldorf, I'm sorry. because the Bay Arena was being redeveloped. And I thought maybe this year, with a more experienced coach, Jim Hankus, they would be able to stretch it out longer. But in fact, they pretty much caved in around the same time as they did last time round. No real reason to explain it, really. I'm not conscious of any particularly bad injuries. I think Stefan Kiesling just stopped scoring. He was a really, really important player. Erin Derdiok is his strike partner up front, and Swiss international. We'll see him at the World Cup. He's just not good enough. He's okay, but he's just not good enough. Kiesling, I think, is a player, and I'm looking forward to watching him in the World Cup.
Do you know if Derdiok's made the Swiss starting lineup recently? Because he was a sub last time we had a major.
That's a good question, Chris, and I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
We'll soon find out.
We will indeed.
Down the bottom of the table, no. Hertha didn't manage to pull off the great escape, and after last season's challenging for the title, this season they've hit rock bottom and then some.
Isn't it just? That just doesn't happen over in England, does it? I mean, that's just extraordinary to be two games away. It was the penultimate game of the last season that they were finally out of the championship race, and now they're bottom by an absolute street. I mean, they were bottom in November. They were down really in November. I don't think anyone, they twitched a little bit, which gave some of the more optimist thinking among us to think that perhaps they might turn it around. But they didn't. They changed the coach, Frieden Funkel, and brought in Fanis Gekas, the Greek international, who's very good at scoring goals for poor teams. But even he could do nothing apart from stand by and watch in dismay as it all fell apart. And they got Arne Friedrich, the German international centre-half, playing for them. They should have a good side. Andrew Ramos is a good player.
They didn't actually concede that many goals. I mean, like Wolfsburg, the new champions, conceded more goals than them, didn't they?
How right you are. And yet they, you know, they just were awful. I think it's, I can't remember the guy's name. It sounds like this dreadful double goalkeeping gaffe from the substitute goalkeeper who came on, and he ended up heading the ball out twice and it being pinged back over his head twice. I think they lost that game by a horrendous amount. And Frieden, and then my other favourite one was when they lost in the last minute, I think it was to Schalke, and Frieden Funkel, and this was, you know, maybe with four or five games to go, Frieden Funkel, the coach, and they cut to him right at the end, and he's to his hands right as soon as the final whistle goes, and they've lost. And he's just tearing up his notepaper like this. And he's like throwing it all down. He's like going, right, that's it. We're boned, guys. We're finished. And he's gone now, of course. But he's been replaced by Marcus Babbel, who was sacked by Stuttgart earlier in the season. So that's a really interesting appointment.
I'll tell you another interesting appointment. Graham mentioned Wolfsburg, and last year's champions had a fairly average season by the end, finished eighth, but all eyes will be on their manager for next season, Mr. Steve McLaren.
Steve. I think Steve will do well, yeah. I've no idea how Steve's going to do there. I've got to be honest, I've got no idea. I mean, they've also, I can't remember his name, but they've also got in a new general manager as well. And in Germany, it's quite important, the relationship between the general manager and the coach. And the coach is not like the manager. Well, there are a few. Magath in Schalke is in charge of the whole show. But mostly they're quite successful, the general manager and then the coach model, the kind of director of football model. So there's quite a lot that could go wrong with Wolfsburg. So I don't think that it could all be laid down to him, but it was very intriguing that one of the first things he said in the press conference was that they needed to keep Edin Dzeko. Now, they're not going to keep Edin Dzeko, and I have a feeling that he's just basically putting something in the bank, because I think he's in for a tough one. Wolfsburg has got a lot of expectations, and he needs to go into the transfer market, and he needs to bring in players, and he won't know that league terribly well. So I think it's a risk. But hey, you know, he deserves his chance, because they're a proper football club with a lot of money behind them, and they could be playing in Europe. I don't think they're in Europe this year.
No,
they're not. So he's got a whole season of domestic football to get down to it, and I think he'll get time. If he can keep winning games, then he will get the time that he needs.
If he gets into Europe, that's got to be considered a success, hasn't it?
Absolutely,
over the first season.
Yeah, but Wolfsburg, remember, are a club that in recent years have become used to qualifying for Europe. So there will be a reasonable expectation that he does precisely that. If he gets them into the Champions League, it'll be an absolute bona fide success. And that's not impossible in the Bundesliga, although very hard.
Of course, the most important thing that's happening now at the end of the season in the Bundesliga, no more Jens Lehmann.
No.
He's retiring.
No. There is no more Jens. No, I'm afraid there's no more Jens.
Which is such a shame. Some of his best moments came this season as well, I think.
I agree.
He did save some of the best stuff till last, didn't he?
He certainly did.
Stealing a fan's glasses, urinating on the pitch. Yeah. Anything else that I missed?
Boots on the net.
Boots on the net. What happened?
Was that this season? There was some.
I think that was last season, the boots on the net.
Oh.
But worth mentioning anyway.
It's just a litany of it. Yeah, we will be sadly. There was talk of him going over to MLS, but that hasn't happened. I'm not quite sure what they'd have made of him there.
To play outfield.
Now, don't be unkind.
To who? Him or?
Just generally, don't be unkind.
Okay, right. Well, we'll leave the Bundesliga there. We'll come to Germany's World Cup hopes in the final part of the pod when we're looking at the World Cup. But let's skip over the Maginot Line and head to France, where there was the usual Gallic drama. Chris, last time you were on here, it was Bordeaux's title to lose, and they lost it.
Yes, back to the old clown car analogy, I'm afraid. they were... Thank you.
Yes. Very good.
they absolutely... capitulated in no uncertain terms. It was just completely unforeseen. Bordeaux entered this season on the back of a tremendous run at the end of the previous season, and all was going well up until sort of Christmas was approaching, and by that stage they were starting to get a few injuries, which turned into a lot of injuries, and then come the new year, a lot of their wins were turning into draws, and then the draws started turning into defeats, and entering the last couple of months of the season, they just gave up completely. I mean, they were just racked with injuries. Confidence was at an all-time low. And in the end, it was they had to settle for sixth place, which is not actually a European place in Ligue 1. So they've gone from finishing in the last eight of the Champions League this season to not even being in Europe next season. That's the depths that they've plumbed to, unfortunately.
Quite incredible. And a famous old name surging up the table to take the title. Not Lyon.
No, Marseille, who, I have to say, Didier Deschamps has done a tremendous job of stabilising a very volatile ship. I mean, again, another member of the classic World Cup winning team from 1998, like Laurent Blanc, who was at Bordeaux up until a couple of weeks ago. And he's just done a tremendous job. He's got them all well drilled and disciplined, and he's got some tremendous players there. Players like Mamadou Niang, who is the top goal scorer this season, who scored 18. And he's just got them playing really well. And the interesting thing was that they were regularly, I mean, right through the season, Marseille were always hanging around down at about sort of fifth or sixth place. Largely by virtue of the fact that they always had at least one or two games in hand. It wasn't because they weren't playing very well. And when Bordeaux suddenly fell to bits around about the early part of early part of 2010, Marseille just stepped up and sort of said, OK, we'll play our games in hand now. And they just eased and breezed their way through to the top of the table and finished off with a run which was not unlike that of Bordeaux's previous season, and totally justified and a great achievement. Their first... league win since 1992.
And we all remember what happened after 92.
Oh, yes.
On their Bernard Tapie and all that. Lyon, can they consider that a good season or a bad season, considering where they were at the start of the season? It looked like they might not even get into a European place. In the end, they've had a Champions League semi-final. Runners-up, OK, they're 6 points behind Marseille, but is that a good or a bad season for them?
I think they've got to be happy with that, although obviously they had that run of seven consecutive seasons where they were just winning the title year in, year out, and you do get the impression that they're going through a period of great change now, and this season just ended was a key one for them, because of course when you've been so used to winning and then to suddenly lose your first title in 7 or 8 years, you've got to quickly do something about it. And they went a bit sort of loopy in Marseille style almost during the summer. They went around sort of hoovering up as many decent players as they could. They got Lisandro Lopez, who was the Ligue 1 Player of the Year actually this year, so he did well for them and certainly paid back some of the money that was spent on him. And they've struggled. They were quite inconsistent this year, Lyon, and one gets the impression they were certainly focusing on their Champions League campaign. Of course, they got to the last four, but quite inconsistent, and it was still in doubt going into the last week of the season whether they'd even finish second. And the fact that they did, I think they've got to be very happy with that second spot. They're back in the Champions League next season. And, OK, they didn't win the title, but you know what they say, there's always next season.
Graham, do you reckon that having team Lyon and Bordeaux, do you think, you know, Champions League, especially the fact that they both did so well, perhaps better than they were expecting, do you think that might have taken them out in them in the domestic table?
I think it's difficult to tell, really. I mean, like, there's always going on the English model where, you know, you'll always get Alex Ferguson moaning about the quality of the opposition or how many times he has to play away after playing in the Champions League. I'm sure these things do mount up for them, but I think, you know, I think with the French league this season, it was so close for so long. I mean, the table at the end doesn't really show that with 4 or 5 weeks to go, there were six teams all within a really decent shout for it. Maybe it just was a. I didn't see Bordeaux play at all last season, not even, so I don't know if they really just, like, you know, burnt themselves out in the first half of the season or.
And all the injuries, as mentioned, so, yeah.
No fairy tale though for Montpellier, who were in with a shout for so long, ended up finishing fifth after being promoted last season.
Yeah, I mean, but that is, I mean, if you're gonna. Excuse me, look at the best achievement of any team in Ligue 1 this season, you could point towards Montpellier because, as we've mentioned before, we used the analogy of Birmingham or Wolves coming up from the Championship last season and getting into getting a European spot, and that's pretty much what they've done. Unfortunately, their form just dropped going into the last couple of months of the season. They started drawing quite a few games, picked it up just in the last couple of weeks and finished fifth. So they're in the playoff round for the Europa League. That's still an amazing achievement, really. I mean, the team that pipped them to the Ligue 2 title last season, Lens, finished 11th, which even that, mid-table, I think if you'd have said Montpellier finishing mid-table, that would have been tremendous. So to get into a qualifying round, to get a qualifying round spot in the Europa League, I thought it was absolutely tremendous. René Girard is the coach and didn't have a lot to work with, but again, made the most of the players, got a good blend of experienced players and young ones coming through, and did a tremendous job.
And just finally down the bottom table, St Etienne playing their normal, consistent 17th place, avoiding relegation ahead of Le Mans, Boulogne and Grenoble.
Yes.
Sarah Cracknell.
Sarah Cracknell, indeed.
Did we ever get through a podcast without mentioning Sarah?
Nope. I'm all for more mentions of Sarah Cracknell.
St Etienne did their... they might as well just pencil them in 17th spot every season because they finished 17th last season. They only stayed up on the last week of last season. This year, they managed to avoid relegation 3 weeks before the end. So a bit of a luxury for them, really, that they could sort of coast through. But they just are incapable of getting any higher up the league. They're only one place behind Sochaux, and they were absolutely dreadful. Had to rely on Charlie Davies having a car crash to inject some interest into their season. Saint Etienne 17th, as per norm.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I'm sure hopefully Ligue 1 will be as exciting as it has been for the last couple of seasons as we go next year. And of course, we'll carry on looking at Ligue 1 and the Bundesliga and all other foreign leagues because, frankly, we just love them all. It's all football and it's all brilliant. We're going to stay with another foreign league in part three. Chris will be giving us the MLS lowdown from the last week. He's had a little breather during this half.
Wake up.
Sorry.
Yawning away.
Just drifted off a little bit.
Good, I'm glad we got you awake there. We'll also be previewing a very small tournament that's happening this summer. It's called the World Cup. You might have heard of it. We'll be talking about it after this. Welcome back. Part three of the Two Fitted to Tackle podcast. A slightly later point in the pod. Eagle-eared listeners may notice that we normally do MLS in part two. We thought we'd bump it down to part three. It doesn't mean it's any... We normally save the best till last anyway. So, Chris... This is the week when I put my first ever bet on MLS.
How did that go?
not particularly well. I put it on Seattle Sounders and San Jose Earthquakes to draw. I did check with you. I checked with Jason Davis as well from Matcher at USA. I said, is this a good bet? You both said yes. And what did Seattle go and do?
Well, they lost.
Well done, Seattle.
The theory was sound, because the theory for certainly me, and I expect Jason as well, would be that Seattle don't score at home.
Which they didn't.
San Jose aren't necessarily that good. They're improving, so not a massive surprise to see it. But it was a good bet. I'm sure you got decent odds on it.
Very good, I think.
And were it not for a goal just 79 minutes from time, you would have been fine.
Yeah, it's a very shame. Bad Seattle, you're in my bad books now. But I mean, that they're really not doing it this season, are they?
No, they're not. They're struggling a little bit, and I think, you know, they will probably get themselves into the sort of bottom end of the playoffs. But they're certainly not going to be right up there like a lot of us suspected.
I did, however, make a small bit of money because I put my second ever bet on MLS. I put that on Houston Dynamo to beat DC United. Good old faithful DC United. Never let me down. They are terrible, aren't they, Chris?
Yes, but they're going to win at the weekend.
Who have they got the weekend?
Chivas.
Okay. You're very confident on that.
Yes, because Chivas are also not that good, although significantly better than DC at their worst moments. But it all depends on whether beating AC Milan in a friendly is going to have any effect on the morale of the team. And a couple of returnees from injury as well.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. A few other interesting results. Columbus, absolutely flying now, seeing off the Red Bulls on their own patch.
Yep, two wins in a week has put Columbus at the top of the East, and they've just absolutely gone flying past the Red Bulls just in 1 week. They beat the Red Bulls 3-1 at Red Bull Arena. Very, very comfortable. And then a fairly dreary game at Kansas City was a 1-0 win, thanks to a second-half goal from Renteria, who also scored against the Red Bulls.
Mm, very good. Topping Western Conference is the Galaxy, who just keep charging on, seeing off Dallas 1-0 away.
Yeah, one at Dallas without Landon Donovan and Edson Buddle, who are on international duty.
You talked about Chivas not being very good, and indeed they weren't. They lost to Real Salt Lake.
Real Salt Lake are very good, so it's probably slightly unfair to read too much into that, but I think, yeah, Chivas are going to struggle to get into the playoffs. I think they're probably dead and buried as far as that's concerned already. Still, you know, made it a single table. They're 7 points clear of DC, so...
Nice little bit of Toronto, perhaps unknown to other people, picking up a win over the Rebs, a 1-0 win.
Yep, Toronto are slowly improving. They're getting themselves up the Eastern Conference with a few solid results like that one. The Revs again aren't exactly top notch at the moment, so it's a fairly big win for Toronto, but I can't see them doing too much. I think Jason's prediction at the start of the season that actually we'd only get two Eastern teams in the playoffs is beginning to look like it's very possible.
And also big game coming up next week, the Crew face the Galaxy, which should be fascinating.
It should be an interesting game, and it's a big game in some sense, but of course they're both going to probably win their sides of the table, and they're both going to make the playoffs. So it's sort of, there's not actually that much riding on it.
Mm. And not that I want to put any pressure on one man in this room, but Graham, are you actually going to go to the New York Red Bulls when you're over there?
Yeah, it's really tempting. I mean, I'm only just going to be on the other side of the river, and you know, to go to the actual New York Red Bulls and to see them play the actual Houston.
It'll be worth it just to see Mike Chabala's hair.
Yeah.
He doesn't know who that is.
It's a shame we don't have a webcam to capture Graham's face at that point in time.
I want to go to Kansas. Because they play in a baseball
stadium. You know
stadium.
What to do.
No. No. That's not what I get. I want to go back to Kansas.
Oh.
No, I want to go because they play in a ballpark.
They do at the moment.
And then they have got their stadium all sorted now, which is mildly disappointing because it's great and they've added some extra seats and stuff. But it's a community ballpark that they play in, and all their fans are basically at one end, and at the other end they've just got this sort of like grass bank where you got these sort of like moochers just sort of like mooching around watching really? Soccer and having a lovely time.
That's the way to go and see
watching people. Soccer on a pitch. I've played five a side on bigger pitches than that.
It's almost Highbury in its smallness.
On the subject of stadium, going back to Blackpool, I like the James Richardson joke this week on Guardian Football Weekly, where he said Blackpool's ground has only got three sides, but at least that's one more than the SPL have got.
That's a good one.
Emulating Oxford. We'll move on from the MLS. We're podcasting over the World Cup, so we might dip in and out when there are MLS games on there. But yeah, we'll obviously do various roundups when we come back from the new season. But as I said, World Cup, nearly June, that stage. Now, before we go into our discussion on the World Cup, I thought I'd surprise people by... I've come here, there's...
Spending money.
Spending money, indeed. No, I didn't just bring in Haribo, I also brought in some a range of crisps. You might have seen that a crisp company has produced a range of flavour cups, they're called, because I don't think they're allowed to use the official World Cup.
Flavour cups?
Yeah, it's the flavour cups.
You call Wonder Bra.
Sounds like a euphemism.
It doesn't sound like a euphemism.
Sounds filthy. Goes back to our off-air discussion on Kelly Dalglish.
With her tunnel report.
Thank you for your flavour cups.
You've completely ruined anything
else. Oh.
Sorry, Gary. It's probably going to be much more fun, that bit, than this bit. I thought, because they've produced flavours from all over the globe, supposedly, I thought we could actually test a few, rate them, because, you know, we perform an important service here.
Let's talk Gary Moore eating. Come on.
Right. I'll take the Pepsi challenge on any of these, Chris. And we're not going to name that.
I'm throwing them out. The first Chris. First one to be drawn is Spanish chicken paella. Over to
Thank you.
Graham, you can have Italian spaghetti bolognese.
Ah. Okay. German sausage in here?
No, I only managed to pick up a few from the supermarket, so no, okay. We've only got six in here.
I've tasted the German breakfast sausage, and I thoroughly recommend it, but I know Chris has got a totally...
I wasn't a big fan.
We haven't got Brazilian salsa, which is just as well, because they are horrible. Absolutely horrible. Oh, Chris, you can have French garlic baguette.
How apt.
Yes. Terry. Oh, Australian barbecue kangaroo.
Wombat.
We've got two more in here.
Old nose, everybody.
South African sweet chutney. I'll take...
Nice.
I'll take that one. Okay, so Chris, what do you make of the paella?
Well, I haven't tried it. I thought we were waiting. I thought we're going to do it live.
Yeah, okay, go for it.
Well, that was appetizing, wasn't it?
And?
Well, he hasn't grimacing too much, is he, there? I think.
That is bloody revolting.
I did wonder if any of them might take a few.
Well, actually, the aftertaste is quite pleasant.
What's it taste of? Why?
I don't know. It's not chicken, and it doesn't taste of paella.
You've never had... You said that you don't like paella, though.
Well, yeah, but I had to come to that decision by trying it.
Okay.
No. They're 1-0 down.
Okay, Chris, you've been merrily munching away on the garlic baguette. Mm. You've got a slightly curious look on your face.
It's difficult to kind of get an image in your mind of perhaps what Charles Aznavour's sputum might taste like, but I suspect this French garlic baguette is probably somewhere on a par with it.
For those of us who don't know who Charles Aznavour is, please describe the flavour.
He was a singer of some repute, I believe. You youngster from days of yore, used to sing things like that.
Was he that was? Oh, I'm thinking of Chevalier who sang.
Oh, it's probably him as well. They all sing like that, don't they? On the continent. But yes,
the Pink Panther.
French garlic baguette. It needs a stronger garlic flavour to make it more credible. That's about the most polite thing I can think of to say about it.
Cheese and onion.
Graham, how is your Italian spaghetti bolognese
he's
going
finished
down?
His. Graham's actually just popped a loo to get rid of him.
It's about as inspiring as Lazio's season's been, I think.
Great gag.
But Terry.
Excuse me. It's beef crisps.
South African sweet chutney, which I've got, is...
Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
These are about as interesting as Matt Damon. They don't taste of anything. This is quite impressive. I've never had a crisp which tastes of nothing. Does anyone want to try?
I quite like these ones, actually. The bolognese ones. They remind me of school.
Oh, what? School?
Yeah.
School.
Oh, school.
Yeah, those little cheap crisps used together with tomato flavoured.
That's
exactly those ones.
We've got one more here, which is the Japanese teriyaki chicken. Chris, you didn't like the paella, so I'm going to give you another chicken-y one.
Oh, the chutney ones are right.
What's for that?
What a pro.
Pass the paella ones over.
I'll steal a paella out of there.
I'm going to try the chutney.
This is really good audio, isn't it?
That one, that one's a bit like eating a cardboard box.
Oh, God, that paella is awful.
Man alive.
Oh, my Lord, that's horrible.
What, is it the paella?
Yeah.
Come on in.
They are grim. They are horrible.
I can't describe how bad that tastes.
That is pet food, that is. That is, really is.
Like vomit.
I'm going to paraphrase Charlie Brook and say that these South African sweet chutney flavour are like excreted battery acid.
So, is anybody else picking up like an end of term feel?
Oh, that's what it's all about, isn't it? What's in your lunchbox?
We're both being allowed to eat crisps at our desk.
Yeah, we can bring games in.
Which we have to say.
I like the teriyaki as well.
If we're picking a winner, which one would we have to.
Teriyaki, is that some kind of joke?
American cheeseburger teriyaki. Is a winner.
Oh. Teriyaki chicken, love.
I haven't had an spaghetti bolognese yet, so.
The garlic one certainly isn't. None of them.
They're all awful.
I can't imagine myself ever being in a shop and thinking, oh, yeah, I really fancy it. One of those.
Japanese teriyaki chicken.
That tastes slightly like really bad bolognese. You can taste the bolognese in it.
Yeah. Like, the paella, though, is...
It's horrible.
Dubious.
Oh, no.
Right, I think we have to go for one, possibly the teriyaki chicken or the garlic baguette out of here, but Chris says American cheeseburger, which I haven't tasted yet.
Oh, that's awful.
It's quite disgusting, but in a slightly weird, endearing way.
Okay.
Where's North Korean dog flavour? That's what I'm looking for.
Okay, right. Well, let's get back onto the football. Chris, you have the honour of answering the first question after the back of that one.
Okay.
If you do hear any crisp munching throughout the rest of this, we apologise.
You won't.
It'll just be a sign of real desperation.
Chris regurgitating.
Vomiting.
Quite possible, yeah.
England first. What do you think Fabio Capello will have learned from their 3-1 friendly win over Mexico earlier this week?
I think he'll have learned that when he hasn't got his Chelsea contingent in the side, they're considerably weaker. But then we kind of knew that because they'd obviously been playing in the FA Cup. But they did look quite weak. I think he will have also learned that when his team haven't got the ball, they need to do a lot more pressing. Otherwise, they just end up sort of being quite sort of passive, frankly, in the game. He may have learnt that Robert Green will be his first choice goalkeeper. There's controversial for you. Although I think we're going to see James probably given a run out, so I'm led to believe in the game against Japan, which means we've now seen all three. Well, by that stage, you'll have seen all three candidates. So I found it quite intriguing, really. Everyone sort of came out and said, "What a terrible performance!" And yet you sort of think, well, if they played that bad and won 3-1 in a World Cup finals match, you'd be quite happy with it. But of course, the real worry is if they played that badly and had that little amount of possession against Spain, for instance, what the consequences would be. But as it is, I was just quite happy with the fact that they played badly and still won 3-1. I think the Mexicans weren't too happy with the way their team played, and they've probably got more reason to complain, frankly.
Graham. Obviously, Gareth Barry is probably the biggest injury worry for the squad. Michael Carrick really didn't do himself any favours in that game at all. If Barry is not fit, what do you see Capello doing? Is he going to have to play the dreaded Lampard-Gerrard axis in the middle of the field?
I'd like to think not, really. I'd like what the system I'd like to see him play is one that a lot of the successful European sides have played with, which is like the 4-2-3-1. I'd like to see Crouch at the top, and behind him, Gerrard, Lampard, and Rooney in a sort of like an attacking sort of three, and then sort of like have sort of like Carrick and perhaps another, I suppose, at the moment.
Scott Parker.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing Scott Parker there. I think he's had a good season. I think he has a good way of making bad teams look better.
Well, for England.
Well, yeah. So why not pick him then?
Carrick's a bit of a worry though. I just sent a shiver down my spine when you just said Carrick. He just doesn't look like he's ready. He's just not played enough.
Well. Yeah, who is though?
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that, and I thought, what have I just let myself?
I mean, like you know, we've got. Yeah, we haven't got that much talent there, I don't think, in the centre of midfield, and certainly not in defence. Defence, we are looking very, very worrying.
It's all right, John Terry's coming back. Hurrah!
Oh, yeah, great.
Terry, as Chris said, Mexico, a side that perhaps after that performance should be a little bit worried.
I get the Mexico question. Thanks.
That's okay.
Please, carry on. Mexico, yeah. Sorry, Kevin.
Well, you have to say that they probably are. You know, if they had any aspirations of going, and Mexicans generally do, they're sort of quite an excitable bunch when it comes to the World Cup. If they had any hope of getting there, they probably need to play a lot better than they did against England.
Yeah, well, I think that they need to defend set pieces a lot better than they did. But I also think, in fairness, they need to have referees and linesmen that have eyes. That might help. But, I mean, yeah, when you've got guys like Blanco coming off the bench for them, you do worry about their depth. I think that England beat a fair to middling international side, which is, I think, is what Mexico are. But because they play possession football, they're attractive, easy on the eye, they're good to watch, and they'll be entertaining. But I don't think they'll be any good.
Chris, England, the national press are absolutely, it's almost negativity, negativity, negativity until they suddenly hit one victory and then it's victory. England can't possibly lose. How do you think at the moment that they're going to actually do? Given how, USA have picked their team, USA aren't too bad, Algeria, meh. You look at the other teams, Australia had that rather not particularly brilliant win over New Zealand. In a friendly, you have to say, actually, their path at the moment, there's not too many teams that they should fear, except possibly if they get Germany.
My big fear is Germany. I don't think there's too much risk of us not getting out of the group. And I think probably Australia, Ghana, I think we probably, on a good day, will get past them. Germany's a concern for me.
Mm.
But I think we will probably get there and hopefully avoid them, so maybe quarterfinals.
Absolutely. Terry, I'll put the Germany question to you because I'm sure you probably...
How I do you am, think, after all, German.
Very normal as well. How do you think Germany will do?
I don't think they'll do very well at all.
I think Serbia are going to top that group.
I think that that's a possibility. I think that Germany may well top the group, but I don't think they'll be good enough to beat England, to be frank. They've got they're missing Balak already. Their forward line is shonky. Mario Gomez isn't terribly good, full stop. Miroslav Klose is good for Germany, but that's okay for as long as he stays good. In the midfield, they are very impressive. Ozil is definitely a player to look out for. They've also got emerging players like Bajduber, who he's bringing in, and Muller's coming in, which is good for Lowe. They're a transitional side, and they've got a massive goalkeeping problem. Hans Jordbuck was nowhere near the German squad until recently. Tragically, the legacy of the season, of course, for Germany is Robert Enke's death, and this was supposed to be his World Cup.
Mm.
But with Mertesacker and Westermann, I think will probably be their back two, and Philipp Lahm and Jerome Boateng. No, I think anybody could have Germany. They will be well organised, of course. And they're very good tournament players, but I think anybody can have for Germany. I really do.
There's a big hole in there for in terms of experienced players now, especially with Balak now gone. There's not that many players in the squad who've got a great deal of experience.
It's natural to fear the Germans.
Mm. Well, Schweinsteiger, okay? I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, and Schweinsteiger is what? I'm sorry, but I mean, I don't rate Schweinsteiger very much at all. He's a good, solid Bundesliga player. He's quite gifted.
Okay, we'll have... Because we've got to wrap up very, very quickly. Coming to the end of the pod. Very quickly, I'm going to go around the table and ask who your tips for the World Cup are. Chris.
Brazil.
Brazil, not Spain.
No.
Other Chris.
I'll go for Spain then. There's a snap on.
Providing that they don't have Paella Chris.
Oh, can do without those.
Graham.
I think I'm going to go for Spain overall in it. Dark horses. I think look out for the Serbians. I think they're going to prove to be good dark horses. I think they could have started off in an easy group, and I think they'll bring possible quarterfinals.
Terry?
I think Brazil will win.
Brazil, okay. Yes.
And the Dutch. Sorry, I forgot to mention the Dutch. A lot of people have forgotten about the Dutch.
They are indeed dark horses. They're not actually fighting each other this time, which does help going into a major
other
tournament.
Football teams are available.
Okay, well,
leave it there. Who do you think?
Me? I think Spain. I think Brazil are, they're very, very good side, compact, going to be very difficult to break them down. Just the words of Thierry Henry after the France friendly with Spain, we just couldn't get the ball off them. Mm-hmm. I think, and the way that they play and the fact that they've got so many players from the nucleus of that brilliant Barcelona side, augmented by the likes of Villa, Torres, Captivia, to be honest, Xabi Alonso as well. You can't really look past
them. They're on course to face each other, I think, in the quarterfinals, I think, aren't they?
I just think the Brazilians will break up the Spanish possession game, personally. That's what I think will make the difference. And I don't trust the Spanish to win back-to-back trophies, either.
Fair enough. You can't trust those foreigners, can you, Terry?
Speaking as a German.
Speaking as a German, I resent that remark hugely, you racist bastard.
And on that note, that is about it for the season. We will be podcasting throughout the World Cup. We'll give advance notice on the blog and Twitter when we're going to do that. It's going to be very much when we can get a bit of time to run into the studio. Just quickly, thank you very much to the Sound of Football team, Terry, Graham, Chris, and thank you as always to Chris, the constant throughout the pod. Thank you to every single guest who's been on the pod this season. We could not have done it without you. And thank you very much for you for listening. And if this is your first time, I hope you've enjoyed it. And you can visit the blog, twofootedtackle.com, twitter.com/twofootedtackle for Twitter, facebook.com/twofootedtackle if you want to become a fan. How many have we got now, Chris?
198.
Go on, become our 200th fan. You know you want to. And finally, if you want to get in touch with us, any questions for the World Cup pods that we have coming up, twofootedtackle@googlemail.com. That is about it. Enjoy a couple of weeks off before the World Cup circus starts, and we'll be back then. Thank you and good night.
Goodbye.
Twofootedtackle.com.
You can be certain that, that Jason Davis and probably Ginge are going to listen to this again. It's not, you fools!